Welcome to Foundation Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're here to talk about Season 2, Episode 7, A Necessary Death. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
I think this was the second time this season where I was seriously challenged with the act of willpower to not just immediately hit next episode.
Right.
That's where we really earn the money watching television, is resisting to go on to the screeners to spoil ourselves so we don't fuck up the podcast. I mean, this is a great episode. It's got a lot of great things going on for it. I do have a concern. About how the episode ends, and kind of like a conversation we had with David Goyer last week. But it's another terrific episode. It's super exciting. I like the statecraft. I like a lot of the monologues and duets. Mm-hmm. Some really great writing. Some jaw dropping visuals with the spacers. They also really elegant. I mean, you know, it's a lot like they had the situation in Dune, where you've got a navigation guild that's dependent on a chemical. But it's like chemical to survive, it's a Jim Hadar situation. So it's mm-hmm. like that's inherently interesting. And the fact that the Foundation has a way to kind of free, I mean, that's the thing. It seems like the Foundation has a lot of soft power here that they're trying to wield. And for the sure. Empire is going to try to wield actual power, and we'll see how it goes. But I don't know. They're starting to tell the story of the Foundation is really being ready for the Empire.
While at the same time, Harry himself just getting totally screwed. Like, all of Harry's plans seem to be failing right now, and I don't know if I buy it. I don't know if there's some other thing that Harry's got to unfold here that says, I kind of expected some of these plans to fail, and if they did, I had contingency plans. Because the human Harry, like Harry being human is a strange thing. I guess he didn't really expect that right now. Him dying is a strange thing. His emissaries to the Empire getting completely shut down. His deal with the spacers, like, not going through. Nothing seems to be going right for the Second Foundation here. But I think that's interesting because it can't be that, right? It can't.
But on the other hand, like, that's one of the pleasures of reading the books, is that, like, every time you see a twist and, like, there's no fucking way that was the way it was supposed to happen. It turns out, no, that's pretty much the way it's supposed to happen. So,
and that's what I mean, right?
Like, now, these Harry events are radically different than they're played. So, like, I don't have any certain knowledge than, like, the exact same thing we saw this, like, oh, how are the Foundation going to get out of it? And, you know, who saw the Invictus coming, right?
Right. And that's the thing. Like, there are little crumbs here and there where it's like, oh, spacers are surprised that he can even track them. That doesn't.
Yeah.
That's not possible according to them. So that's the thing. I'm like, none of this can actually be falling apart the way it seems to be falling apart. And I'm excited to see what, you know, other machinations are in the works.
And all the world building felt really cool. I liked, I mean, this is kind of like a novel feature. No one knew that this could happen. But the way that the spacers can at least maybe you have to be genetically related spacers, but they can, like, communicate through hyperspace in
apparently,
real time.
Yeah.
That was fucking cool. And I think there's a couple significant glances from She Who Is Center and She Who Shines Brightly that I thought at the end of the Imperial, what would you call that? Meeting that might be suggested that they're exchanging some skepticism with the Empire. But I don't know. Okay. I thought that
it's a great offer. Episode. And I like that. I was like, oh, this offer from Hober is so obviously good on the face of it. They're just going to take it. Right. And this will be the next chapter where Empire realizes, oh, we're totally screwed because now we can't move around. No, it goes the other way because it's too risky. They've got a thing that they have accepted already, right? There's a status quo, and upsetting that might cost them a lot more. So I thought it was
also
fascinating that they don't take the offer.
And I like also, because I assume the She Who Is Center is their leader, their ruler, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting as a counterpart to Empire, who doesn't ever really have any skin in the game. You know, she's talking about like, oh, just 20% an acceptable loss. You're like, oh, maybe she's one of the elites that don't have to give up their children. But no, that's not the case. She's coming from a place of trauma where it's like it could be a lot worse. And sure. from the their perspective, like, this is one vial of Ketracel White or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Well, it could be a trick. Like, maybe the Foundation took 100 years to synthesize this vial. It's a Harry Truman end of the World War II situation where it's like, you don't have any of these fuckers we got. We just did two. We might have 100. We didn't have any more, it turns out. So it's like, it's a lot of trust, and Harry had to have known that. So it's like, there's some things you could easily see him account for, but then you see his corpse bobbling in the execution tank, and it's like, did he
account for that?
Yeah. And that's the thing, the fact that it's one of the fascinating things to explore in a novel is like, how do you account for outliers? Like, the very nature of an outlier is something that you don't have data points for and you can't account for. So how do you do that? Especially when you have people who can predict the future and read people's minds. And, you know, because that's like half of human nature is essentially Nash equilibriums and prisoner's dilemmas that don't work if you could read people's minds.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's one of the bigger questions I have. Hopefully we get answers on that.
And if I hadn't said it yet, I'll say it again. Another episode of jaw-dropping visuals. Hober ripping a jump gate open in the middle of this spacer ship was super cool.
Yeah.
Even little things. Like, I thought the mole squid things were pretty well realized. And
oh, yeah, yeah. That one's a little... That effect is a little rough around the edges, but come on.
You
they
thought
can't
so?
All be perfect. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just I'm... Maybe these things are more gelatinous than I think they are.
I think so. I think they're like the way real squids are. But
they were jiggling around like jello shooters, and I was like, is that how an any animal?
I did wonder what they gave Rachel House. Is she chewing like on a? Did they make like a couple gummy versions of those? And they kind of did a little bit of CGI smoothing and whatnot, because it's just like when you see Emilia Clarke eating a horse heart. Like, no fucking way she's eating a horse heart.
That's
like these are not even real animals. So like, what is it?
Yep.
But and that's the other thing.
Maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's air.
The other thing I really appreciated is like, I thought the writing was great, because a lot of these positions that I am biased against, because for whatever reason, I think are extremely well argued and coming from a position where they're like steel manning the arguments. Even Empire, I thought, did a pretty good job of exposing the potential hypocrisy of Seldon while also shining in massive spotlight on his own. But it's clever.
No, I find myself listening to the things that people I view as villains are saying and going, from a certain perspective, you're not wrong. You're not entirely wrong.
It's like in Miller and Expanse.
It's your reaction to it that makes me ick, you know?
It's like in Miller and Expanse blew the protomolecule researcher's head off, and like Holden's like, what the fuck did he? He's like, this guy was starting to make too much sense. And it's like,
he's a bad guy making sense. I got to take him out.
Yeah. So we got a worm tongue situation here. We need to excise the poison. But it's, a lot of great stuff in this episode.
It's good. I really like the Empire stuff, too, with him pushing back against the onslaught that Sereth has been bringing, because I feel like he's been cowed in literally every scene before this. He's been trying to play it off like he's not scared, like he's not worried about how much she knows and how she's acting. In this scene, I felt like it came back around where he really is not. He's realizes that the game is up, right? She now knows basically for a fact that he had her family killed, and he's now leaning into the power that he has. And I think it's a different day than we've seen in the last couple episodes, and it's a day that's more exciting to me.
Yeah, I think this is the death of the day that had hope that he could have maybe a conventional relationship with this woman. And have, like, because I think there's a little bit of a fantasy where he wanted that. He wanted, sure, she's going to be put on the spot, but, I've worked on my charm and my diploma and my bedroom skills, and we're going to be a happy family. And that if he had that hope that he was entertaining, it died this episode.
And those lines about, you know, the cultivation that they've done with their personality and the way they speak and all this, I think it's fascinating. We could talk about it when we get there. But yeah, I'm really liking the Empire stuff too. And then the seduction of Dawn is so good.
Oh.
So many possibilities there.
Yeah. I mean, like, what? I don't know. What do you do? You're 19 and a hot girl comes up and says, put a baby in me before your stupid older brother can. I'm fertile. Oh, God.
I don't know. She also says, put your dick in this dick slicer. And I'm like,
that's
a
scary. Have you seen the movie Ice Pirates?
No.
So there's a scene where these guys, this is a stupid 80s like Star Wars parody, essentially. And these intergalactic aristocrats have captured our merry band of pirates. And they're going to turn them into like neutered and brainwiped slaves. And they show these guys going down this like conveyor belt and the machine that's going to unman them.
Oh, no.
In fact, it might even be an homage. It looks a lot like this thing. This chomper, you know.
But it's
the opposite. This is going to retunnel a new vas deferens for this guy.
Apparently 20 seconds or something of nanobots.
Hmm. I bet that's a good 20 seconds.
And then 20 seconds of pleasure when they make love.
And you know Day's going to insist to be awake for it, too. Because he's so paranoid.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see it.
We saw the nanoworms weaving through his flesh. He's used to it. Shall I talk through my concern?
Okay, yeah.
It's possible, and we just talked about this with Goyer, so he knows, like, it's like we talked about, it's like, you know, with all the ways you can kill someone and rebring them back to life, do you ever worry that, you know, these deaths are not going to be meaningful? I think it's interesting that two episodes in a row we have cliffhanger deaths.
Of major characters.
Now major characters, and, like, I'm sitting there at the end of the episode just, like, gasping, and I'm like... Is this a giant swing where they're just going to kill two major characters and holy fuck? And again, there's other Harrys, but
right.
Salver is a unique person.
Huh?
Or are they going to just like, you know, it's just going to be undone next episode, easy peasy, in which case, you know, my gasp when Harry died, you know, when Harry and Salver died the next time will be half as loud. And then eventually, so it's like... I know they know the dangers, but it's like one of those things where it's like, boy, this is such a big swing and it's such obvious. Like, it feels like it's schmuck bait. Like, it's like, you know what? Yeah, obviously they're not going to kill Harry and Salvor, but maybe
I feel that too. I'm definitely that it's the biggest reason that I want to just click play next on this episode is
right.
I don't really buy it that they're going to kill Salvor right now, but I would say it would be a huge swing if they did.
Yeah.
I would definitely miss that character because I think season two, she's really coming to her own and I'm starting to like her a lot. But I also want to like point out she's not dead yet, right? It's not like Harry. If Harry comes back to life, you know, that's kind of the... It's not necessarily schmuck bait because he's everywhere, right? But like...
Right.
She's not dead. Her brain's just turned off and she's face down in the water. And it doesn't seem like there's anyone here who would want to save her.
It's just like Harry wasn't dead last episode, but it seems like he's definitively dead in this one.
I think he was pretty dead last episode. The way that they pull out that camera with him with his eyes open, not moving underwater. I felt like he was dead.
Had been Salvor jumping in, like I would obviously and believe that she could get him out and resuscitate him, and he'd. So it's like that's what I'm saying.
There is
like
no brain death there yet, for sure. Yeah. But like, yeah. I half expect. So I made this prediction about Harry being, you know, a human robot hybrid thing that maybe he can breathe underwater and he's not actually dead. I don't know if that's on the table, but if it is, and Tellum walks away from this scene within 12 seconds, 30 seconds, 2 minutes. I believe that a Harry that doesn't need to breathe could wake up and realize, oh, Salvor is here. Let me get her out of the water. Although he's chained. I don't know how he would do that.
Can a humana form? I know she's cradled in his like arm. So like I think
she's
he
right
could probably like, okay, I'm still alive. You live too. And now help us get us out of here.
Right.
But then again, like Tellum would be able to read all that, I feel like. So they also explain the... if he's a humana form...
Harry well.
I buy that because they also just, you know, they fully pulling Demerzel, cat out of the bag. She's a humanoid form robot, something we know. But like it's interesting that they mention that phraseology right as you're debuting this theory. It could be like that would be actually I would actually find that be a pretty nice subversion. But that's the thing. It's like there's a lot hinging on the next episode because and again, this is not fatal. Like if they do schmuck bait, every show does schmuck bait every once in a while. But it's like radiation. Like
too big a
schmuck bait will make you die, and like it's lethal
and
over time.
Exposure.
Every exposure, the audience like desensitizes to it. So, but you know, obviously from a conversation, everyone on the show is well aware of this. So
they're thinking about it all the time. Yeah,
they're thinking about it. Whether they get the balance just right, I don't know. But that's the only concern I have.
But I felt that feeling, you know, play next. I felt my thumb clicking that button. So they nailed something, right?
So bad. Yeah.
Yeah. All things have a cycle. First the podcast, then the ad. Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Math is never just numbers. This isn't just a podcast. We're back with more Foundation. Anyway, let's get into the recap and we can talk in detail about this stuff.
Let's do it.
We start off with Polly and Constant being held in a kind of cell. I don't know. This felt like a train station almost that they're being held in with a bunch of guards. And they're being lightly tortured with lights. They think they failed their mission. And then Day and Demerzel, we see them kind of looking on and considering what to do with them. and Day assures Demerzel that she will always have a place here, even once he's destroyed the dynasty.
Yeah, can we talk about what is actually happening here? Because they talk about, okay, she's like down and down it goes. At first I'm like, is this like a big slow moving elevator that's going to take him to the core of the planet or something? But then it goes, the, you know, the light pattern goes to the bottom and it bounces to the top. It's like, and they talk about it like, well, this is to keep you from committing suicide by boredom. And is this like a very high tech sophisticated way to kind of like when we back when we invaded, was it Panama? Noriega, Manuel Noriega, we like blasted his house with like loud rock music for days on end to drive him crazy and make him surrender. Is this that, like,
yeah, or the torture where sleep. you keep prisoners awake by loud noise and lights and stuff?
Yeah,
or it's a pretty, like a water torture kind of thing, right? The drips, the constant drip. You wouldn't think, but in aggregate, that's a
No,
torture.
Deprivation of sleep is a classic torture method. It also softens people up for interrogation. So I think that's what they're going for, but it's like one of those things where it's like, you know, it's magic technology, so who the fuck knows?
Yeah.
It's clear on subsequent watches that Harry briefly possesses Constance's body when she says, you know, if that were possible, would any of us still draw breath, right? That's like our first inkling that there's a little bit more Harry, a little bit more than meets the eye going on with her.
Yeah, I didn't understand necessarily the mechanism that was all taking. Maybe we could talk about that when we get to the actual throne room scene.
Yeah.
But I like the line, just as Rios arrives in the Outer Reach reaches out. Interesting. Yeah, he's seeing the sort of pieces of Harry's plan interlocking in a way, right?
Is he medium suspect the bell is involved, or is he just admire? Is he just because I considered that, but I think he was just more of like the suspicious timing, not because he says it's just as Bell Rios arrives to the outer realms, they reach out to us. The way he named them, I thought it's like, does he thinking he's betraying them? But I after the entire episode, I don't think so. I think he's just, you know, it's suspicious timing. And the fact
and he's always got a base level of suspicion with Bell, right? Because he has to fight his orders. So, you know, there's going to be an inherent like, I don't like this guy.
Right. And, you know, that's the thing is like, I thought that it was also interesting how they had that statement about like, you know, they have sent the blind angels after me. Are they capable of that? She says, it's just a problem, Empire. We have no idea what they're capable of.
We thought we knew. Well, we didn't even think we knew. We thought they didn't exist up until now. And now we find out they not only do they exist, but they have technology beyond our own. That's terrifying.
Yeah. So this is it's funny. Cause like I've been trying to figure out this Demerzel Cleon 16th day situation. You know, it's like, you know, who's taking advantage of whom? I haven't seen Demerzel this fucked up since she ripped her face off last season. And I started thinking, when I started thinking about that, I'm like, oh my God, this is still the same individual that ripped her face off in like shattered fragments of loyalty last season. This is still a deeply disturbed individual. And it seems like she's just barely, like, I think she has strong feelings for Empire, for this particular Empire. And he's got strong feelings for her.
Did she rip her face off after killing Dawn? Is that when she did that?
I think so. It wasn't after she killed the luminary, right?
No.
That was the next episode.
Maybe?
Those were all stressors leading up to it. It could have been, yeah. But like I said, that was, to me, seemed like a robot suffering from the psychosis of multiple overlapping rule violations. Which they kind of addressed this episode.
They name check the three laws. And we'll get to that stuff. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Demerzel is still a cipher to me. I don't know exactly where her loyalties lie. I know we're probably going to get some more information on that later in the season. But also,
I hear 9 is the big Demerzel dump.
Yeah, we'll see.
Let me ask you this. Did you clock Day saying that my children might not resemble me?
Mm-hmm.
This is just he's talking about the novelty of mixing new DNA. He's not pre-suspecting one of his brothers.
I don't think he has, or being
insecure about not being 100% Cleon himself.
I think it's just the new nature of family to him.
I agree. I was just asking. But the bottom line is he's emotional, she's emotional, and she looks like she's having a hard time keeping it all together.
And then Rue gets in the mix here and is trying to stir some stuff up. And Sarah are stirring shit up. Rue says she's not happy that Sarah embarrassed Day in public. She thinks that's a dangerous thing. Dimmerzel shows up to spring a surprise physical on Sarah. They're actually going to, it's time to harvest her eggs and a whole bunch of stuff. We'll see. As they walk to the exam area, Sarah tells Dimmerzel that she knows she's a robot and asks if she'll serve her once she's married to Day. She says she will serve Empire, which is not, I think, the answer that Sarah was looking for.
Fascinating scene.
Mm-hmm.
That cuts to the heart of a lot of things we've talked about and suspected. You know, we knew she served the Empire since at least Cleon the First, because we saw them planning the space elevator and the genetic dynasty. Mm-hmm. But any other masters? And she says not directly. And then she talks about the three laws. And now she's only bound by one law, which I immediately thought about Goyer talking about reprogramming a robot.
Yes.
And, you know, I guess it's also fair to, when you're talking about the nature of copying, the control C versus control X, like, could there be echoes of the previous code that, like, yeah, she's overwritten with the desire to serve Empire, but is there still like that 1-2-3-0th law rattling around in there? Has to be, or otherwise she wouldn't be having this psychic distress.
And Empire is such a more nebulous thing than the concept of humanity. It's fairly easy to define humanity.
Right.
Defining Empire is a different thing entirely, I think. And that's where it gets complicated and interesting, frankly.
And she also says, like, so the other thing is, like, I don't think robots... Would Dimmerzel be allowed to lie to Sarah, tell an outright fabrication? Because... When she says, are there any other survivors of the robot pogroms? She says, to my knowledge, I am the last one. I don't think there's very much wiggle room. Like, is there, to my knowledge? Do you think her memory's been altered?
It could be a straight up lie, for one.
Okay.
Because she's not Empire yet. I think that's a distinction needs to be made.
True.
And to her knowledge, leaves a big loophole, you know, for there being others out there. She just might not be aware of him.
She says, to my knowledge, because you might not know, but like, I don't think her memory has been altered, because it seems like she's pretty confident that she has an unaltered memory of all of the Cleons. Like, she's the last backup of reserve if you trust her.
Well, and if she can trust herself, would she know? You know, is it more like a Cleon being edited where they wouldn't even know?
Well, if her distributed conscious, again, it's like, how distributed?
And she clearly understands that she used to be bound by these laws, but now she's bound by a different law. So she has some continuity there that maybe she wouldn't have if she were altered significantly. I don't know.
But that's also, yeah, when she says, when the time comes, will you serve me? I will serve Empire.
Yeah.
That's a non-answer.
It sure is.
Because, like, it seems that Empire literally is Day at the lowest level.
Right now, yeah. Yeah. And maybe, yeah, throughout the dynasty, it's always been Day.
Yeah.
All right, Sarah is examined for fertility, and they want to harvest her eggs, but she says, not until we're married. And Dimmerzel allows it. Dimmerzel and Sarah talk in private, and she tells Sarah to think of the way her parents died and imagine how similar it might be to the way she works. She's given up just the whole game here, right? I mean, there's nothing left hidden in the arrangement that they have now.
Why do you think Dimmerzel does relent?
I really don't know. I don't know, because Sarah has no power in this scene. It's almost on the good grace of Dimmerzel that she skirts by, you know, having this opportunity to approach Dawn later.
I feel like it goes back to what we talked about with, like, Day still has hopes to have a happy, you know, happy wife, happy life. And Demerzel knows it's just like, yeah, this would be an outrageous bodily insult to someone who you wanted to, you know. So I was
like, yeah, but then in the next breath, she's saying, "We killed your family."
Well, that's the. But also, you know, Rue tries to smooth things over a couple times. She tries to warn him, like, look, you're being a little bit, you know, bullheaded about this. You need to back off.
You're poking the bear, yeah.
When there's some great lines in here where she's like, you're not harvesting anything until we're properly married. And she's like, well, you're Demerzel says, you're no position to argue. And she's like, Demerzel, I can argue from any position, which is hilarious because she's flat on her back with her legs up in the air.
And she's
doctor's hands up in her business.
Right.
That's the thing. The great scene dropping... I said all this is happening while she's having her groin traumatized.
Like, oh, yeah, yeah.
The guy's not. I thought he was being a little bit, especially at the end, a little bit rough with the innards.
Yeah, potentially.
Which I've heard tell, not a super fun thing to begin with.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah. Luckily, when they probe around my nether regions, I'm usually knocked out. So,
see, that's the thing. I'm at the age where I get the annual invasion for the doctor. So it's I get a little But he's not like shoving some plastic duckbill and cranking me open either. That's like a whole other kettle of fish.
Totally.
So I thought that was like a strong scene, just like the way they staged it. It's just like everyone is in such a position of every conceivable advantage over Sereth, and she's still like taking on all comers and antagonizing Demerzel. And the line she's like, look, you're imperial property. And she shoots back, well, you would know, wouldn't you?
That's the thing, right? Like, she's physically compromised in this scene, but Demerzel is informationally compromised. Her secret is known. And I think if it were to get out there, there would be a lot of unrest about that.
Yeah.
The hypocrisy, the naked hypocrisy of it is shocking.
I think we've observed, just the set example size of, you know, what, three people is Rue and the Handman and Sereth. But, like, I think you're supposed to understand that the average human hates and fears robots.
Uh-huh.
Like, as virulently as any race of people have ever hated and feared another one. And it's like the boogeyman.
I mean, there's a reason it's been thousands of years since they've had robots, right?
Yeah.
That's so ingrained in the culture.
Yeah, because like many other great science fiction universes, the robots almost wiped us out, and we had a massive reaction to that. I'm glad they're continuing to explore this. It is interesting because like they're showing that, you know, Demerzel has like real emotions, and they're not just like confusion and stuff, but she can have like sorrow. She can be insulted and angered.
Mm-hmm.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you exactly why she allows this, other than Sereth knows her secret and she doesn't want it getting out there. And if she forces the issue here, there might be some reckoning on that.
I think Day has her on a leash, but it's also, and I think that Demerzel probably didn't want to say that thing at the end, but she was provoked into doing it. I actually wonder what Day would think if he knew she said that.
I don't know, because I look at, like, what is the play there? Is it to intimidate? Because it's certainly an intimidating line.
And it also, like, Sereth overplayed. She didn't confirm. She's just saying that this is the kind of destruction I'm capable of.
Mm-hmm.
But just, yeah, like,
oh,
I said,
no, she
I,
doesn't confirm it, but then Sereth goes over today and his reaction to it all but confirms it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No one's going to come out and say, we killed your family.
Right. What I wonder, inferring. like what Demerzel would say if she's called on the carpet. She's like, I didn't actually say we killed her. I'm just saying that, like, I'm capable of something like that, so watch out.
I just say, whoever did kill her, damn, they did a great job. Yeah. Whoever killed your family is awesome. Holy shit.
First-rate assassinating, let me tell you.
And there's a shot at the end, or sort of the middle of this scene before everybody's dismissed and Demerzel and Sereth talk in private, where she kind of looks over at her handman and all but says, get that device for me, because she sees the nano probe that's going to re-tunnel Day, and she wants that for her purposes. So she's formulating the plan like right here on the table.
I thought it showed a lot of strength for Sereth to keep her outburst inside herself until at least Dimmerzell got out of the room. Like, Dimmerzell definitely saw she's upset, but, like, fucking Sereth broke down.
Yeah, something she's not quite as effectively able to do with Day once she, like, really confirms that not only is it this robot that is acting alone, but my future husband also is the
that
one
I
who
cannot get
this.
Out. There's no way out of this relationship. It's death or what? Revolution.
Yeah, the only way out is through at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but also Day's kind of stuck with her because we talked about if she dies mysteriously.
Oh yeah,
it's going to. There's no way he doesn't come out of this looking weak. You know.
Yeah.
So no, his best effort is to keep up public appearances, even though they hate each other. I love it. It's a Cersei Robert Baratheon situation.
I was going to say, totally Game of Thrones. All right. Salvor tries to convince Gale to leave Ignis, and she's unable to read anyone here, and it's giving her a bad feeling. And then a sighted child, Josiah, comes up and fetches them to prepare for the feast. There's a really strange filter on this scene. It's a little bit different from some of the filters we've seen before. It's kind of a reverse fisheye.
I thought it was the same filter they're using to show when psychic powers are happening.
This might be the difference. So I saw somewhere in an interview where they were using two different effects here. One in camera, because they like to shoot everything they can effects-wise in camera, and then augment with CG where they need to. And so those effects were slightly different, though they were trying to match them up as closely as they could. So this might be an in-camera thing where they used a funky lens.
Because I was trying my new theory is that these lens effects are triggered by any act of psychic power.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know that's all, because like I think Salver's being suppressed, which I think would be a psychic power, but a lot of her scenes are clean.
Uh-huh.
And but like it's odd because like clearly, you know, Gale's here meditating on primes and working on her psychic powers, and the field is in full effect, and it lasts up until she throws Salver against or across the path, and then it stops. But it seems like this, and I'm like saying, it's like, oh, so we rewatched the last few episodes of Tellum, and we looked at the episode and we looked at the scenes with like the funky effects versus not, like, could we come to a clear and fast understanding of when things are being fucked around with and when things aren't?
Probably can. I assume it's just a consequence of Gale doing whatever mental meditation she's doing here.
Yeah.
Because she's doing her thing, which is counting the primes, and then she's also sitting on a rock like Yoda or Luke meditating and using the Force, right?
I wonder if they're consistent, because like in Star Wars, anytime anyone uses the Force, light side, dark side, there's always like a rumble in the you know soundtrack that you audibly hear the distortion the Force is doing. But you don't have, like, you know, you wouldn't have to do that, you know, like if every True. You know, if Yoda's just kind of like using his, like, you don't have to always do that. It's like it could just be that they're doing an effect and they don't have to be consistent. It might not be right for us to be using these storytelling cues as like tells, but we'll see. I'm still keeping, that's my current theory, and I got some other outgrowths to that later on the episode.
And this is the hilarious culty thing that makes me immediately dislike Tellum, is she preaches this openness and everybody's talking about how great of a place this is because you can't hide anything, everything's out in the open here, and yet what's happening to Salvor this entire time? Her powers are being confused and stifled, and she's unable to access them. It's the exact opposite. They are preaching one thing and doing exactly the opposite.
Yeah, it reminds me, you know, because the cult I grew up in, they prided themselves on how open and how brotherly everything was, and, you know, there's no secrets. But, like, every single person had to wear a mask as a consequence, because you had to appear that you are this when no one can be that, you know. So, like, to me, this had me putting my hand, like, reaching for my gun, put my hand in my wallet and slowly backing away. Because anytime, like, someone's in the early phases of, like, maybe fucking around with the cult, and they're like, well, now's not the time to pull. No, now is definitely the time to pull threads. Because by the time you push those doubts down for a couple years, and you're going to be in too deep.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, like, I'm on Salvers, but, like, also Gale's got, like, we can't fuck around with this. There's something here we need. Tellum's got it. Like, we, you know, they're like, we're trying to kind of run a scheme on them too. I don't know.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes for Salvor. She goes down to the beach. Yeah, we kind of hinted at this scene a little bit, but she talks with Loran. It's the guy who pretended to be Hugo. And he apologizes for kissing her and promises that she'll love it here because no one can hide anything. And Salvor sees a boat being pulled in and gets a bad feeling even after flipping her coin. And then they go to the feast.
Yeah, he notices this and uses the feast as a distraction.
Does. Yeah. And we get introduced to the ghost mollusks here, which are apparently a great source of protein.
And also, these other said that, you know, Salvor's, you know, because she's definitely not as talented right now as Gale is at her various abilities. And she's like, oh, you guys are excited because Gale's here. And he's like, no, Tellum sees that your talents are just as important, which is interesting.
Yeah, maybe in the way that they're connected to each other. But yeah. I don't know, because the end of this, she certainly doesn't value her talents much if she's willing to throw them away.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. I was super curious, like, why is she looking over at this boat? I didn't connect the dots until later in the episode.
I did too. I was like, why? Because I did not assume, although that's very smart, that Harry would be off on some other island or something.
Uh-huh.
I just thought it'd be like
or
some
around
kind
the
of
coast. Yeah.
Yeah, just around the coast a little bit away. You know, an easy walk. I didn't think that they'd actually transit. I was like, yeah, what the fuck are you gonna learn from their fishing data? But
right.
Yeah. The last resting place of Harry and Seldon.
Apparently. And then Salvor and Gale feel the ghost mollusk's pain when they're boiled alive for the feast. Tellum says, yeah, it's normal. And goes on a self-righteous speech about the nature of pain and humanity's relationship with it versus the Mentallic's relationship with it. It's all stuff that I'm like, you're not technically wrong. You know, I don't know if I value the pain of a plant the way I do the pain of an animal, but sure, if you want to view it from that certain perspective, Obi-Wan, then yeah, you're technically right.
Yeah, I mean, there is this, like, the cost of living is destruction. Like, there's not a single thing other than plants that are able to derive their sustenance for free without preying on something else. And even some plants are carnivorous.
We are in the sphere of thinking beings.
We are fortunate enough at this era in human development that if we continue to go down this path of valuing all living things equally, that we could probably right now pull off a vegetarian, vegan diet. And probably in the next century, we could, even if we didn't want to eat plants, like, we could literally harm no living thing. I don't know how I feel about all
proteins
that.
Proteins and...
But I absolutely agree with Tellum that if we had to feel the pain and the cost to other things for our survival, that a lot of the bullshit that happens here in this planet wouldn't happen. Like, the curbing of excess, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, the trouble comes down to the sort of excuse and the way you can use that philosophy of honoring pain to justify horrible acts. And that's where it's me, because she's justifying Harry's death. She's justifying Salvor's own death in those same terms. Right. I mean, that's what the title of this episode is about. And it's a philosophy that is technically correct, but in the wrong hands, it can be used for abhorrent things.
True, but you could say that literally about any school of thought. I've yet to see a school of thought humans can come up with that can't be twisted. And you know what? We should kill those other people.
and that's exactly why the things that she's saying that are right don't assuage my distrust and dislike of her in any
way. Yeah, because another way to look at that is if you're feeling the pain of everything that you... That's another way of saying you are becoming desensitized to the pain of destroying living things.
Uh-huh. And you would think beings that can feel that would have a responsibility to do better. Stop eating the higher forms of life. Start figuring out how to survive without these things, not find a way to desensitize yourself to the pain.
But on the other hand, they're also extremely sensitized to their own pain that they, you know, like if I take their word and they're stronger together, they probably feel, I don't know if it's on a daily basis, but they're intimately familiar with all the ways that they have been preyed upon collectively, you know, from other individual experiences, right? And when you look at a guy like Harry, who's coming here and say, I got a mathematical formula that says that you guys need to work for me, that we can prevent. Like I said, it's like I'm a little bit softer on Tellum. I don't know that she's evil. Or if she's evil, she's evil like Magneto, where it's like, damn, there could have been a lot of things happened to keep her from being Magneto, and that none of those happened. So it's like,
sure.
Yeah, I don't want to be the human destroyed by Magneto, but also I'd be the first human to say we kind of had it coming from the way we've been treating these mutants and our fellow man for hundreds and thousands of years. So,
right. No, I feel
evil
you there.
Or not, I don't know.
I don't know if I would label her evil or not. I don't think I could get on board with her philosophy here. I think it's like, you know, if a child breaks, so if your child breaks something in your house,
yeah,
you don't freak out and say, why the fuck did you break, you idiot? Like, what are you doing? You know better. Because they don't know better. That's the humans in this scenario, right? Whereas the sighted, they know the pain they're causing.
Yeah,
they should try and do better. And you can blame them for the pain that they cause.
This is true.
So
there's a lot of truth in the world. It's almost too big to fit it all in one box.
Right. And it's hard to take a hard and fast side on this stuff because, yeah.
And it's also like
she's right.
The way that I think Rachel Haas is playing her, like when she bites that mollusk, when she's like... there's like a little sparkle in her eye and a slight smile that like undercuts the solemnity. Like, I think there's a way that you could deliver this and it feels very grave. Like, you can see like the chief of the Na'vi in Avatar saying this stuff and like, nobody, but like, it wouldn't be with a sneer, right? There's a little bit of a sneer, but there's also a very touching sincerity to her other students. Like, I thought I was really... taken aback by one of her acolytes standing there stone-faced but with a single tear running down his eye at the idea that Salvor is going to die for their cause. Like, it is, I think, a genuine thing that is probably fucking with a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they feel that pain, for sure.
Yeah. Uh-oh, our dynastic empire is experiencing some genetic drift. We'll be right back. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. The algorithm says the podcast will continue. Welcome back to Foundation.
All right, let's go over to the Spacers, who are not happy to see Hopper and want to kill him. until he shows them some opalesque, which is a substance that they're dependent on to survive, and it's also tightly controlled by the Empire. He says that Harry Seldon can actually synthesize this stuff, which they thought was impossible, and he shows them that his ship doesn't require spacers to operate and asks them to ponder the consequences of that if Empire suddenly didn't need spacers anymore. And all they need to do for the Opalisk, all the Opalisk they could ever want, is to help Foundation kick Empire in the nuts.
Yeah, I think that it's such a heady idea, the idea that like a truly spacefaring civilization would have no preference even to be in a galaxy. Like, do you understand? We're talking about going, because they said that their desire was to sail past the galaxy into the ocean of the universe.
Yes, yes.
I can count on one finger the amount of sci-fi universes that consider extra galactic travel, and it's the Ian M. Banks culture series.
Okay.
Because it's a crazy fucking idea for almost anything else. Like, you think it's far between stars? You talk about intergalactic distances and distance between galactic clusters. But that's what this species' ambition is. It almost feels like that's kind of what they were created for. And they were created to do this, but they can't realize their purpose because they're shackled by this empire. It's a fascinating concept. And I don't know, again, I don't know exactly how rigorously they do the math. I know they have science advisors, but then sometimes they have planets orbiting each other within each other's atmosphere. I got the idea that these spacers, you know, when Bell and Glaywin are on their bridge and they're like, oh, we're not coming to them, they're coming to us, and they just immediately appear.
Mm-hmm.
I almost feel like the spacers travel is damn near instantaneously. And I don't think all jump travel is like that, because Gale woke up during one. So, like, there's like, it's probably quick minutes, hours, days, but it's not instantaneous. This shit seems like it's instantaneous, unless just happened to be hanging out around Bel Rios's fleet.
Yeah, that's interesting. As another wrinkle in, like, what does the Empire control here? Because they clearly, you know, control the spacers through this Opalesque. But the Empire doesn't have the ability to travel instantaneously. So if the spacers do, they're withholding that from Empire. Does Empire know that?
I mean, it's clear that they not use the same technology because, like, visually.
Right. Uh-huh. Does Empire know that they're withholding that ability? And would they be pissed off if they did?
Yeah, I have so many questions about the home swarm, how they track it, how often it stays in real space versus hyperspace. Like, how do they collect the time? I guess they don't collect it. They show up probably for their Opalesque, and that's when they sting them for the 10%.
Uh-huh. I would assume so. How do they keep track of 10%? How do they say, we know how many births or whatever happened?
There's a lot of unhappy she with probes up her vaginas with a lot of Imperial doctors doing some
apparently
some invasive stuff, probably.
So I have a lot of questions around it, but it's fascinating. It's not bad questions, right? It's all,
yeah.
And how does this stuff work? It's cool.
Yeah. That spacers are just a fucking just a really cool concept.
And even dealing with this grandiose entity, Hover is still Hover, right? He's like, no, no, breathe it, eat it, whatever you guys do with it,
right?
And talking about helping us kick Empire the nuts, it's so good.
And it's like, you know, like, this is a balance changer, because she's like, you know, what's Empire gonna do with you when you don't need us, or he doesn't need you anymore? It's like, but he does need us. He's like, well, look at our ship.
It's a threat, but the risk is very high. I mean, all of the factors here are well balanced, I would say.
The only criticism I'd have, and it's a very slight criticism, I don't even know it's a valid one, is that she who is centered, I thought, would spend a little bit more time before she just goes and calls the cops. You know, like, this is such a big thing. Uh-huh. It's felt a little impetuous, but...
Well, she's made her judgment, and it's time to act, I guess.
Like, but it's like, whatever. That's pretty.
Here's what I'm excited about. Mm-hmm. I think it's one thing to say, this is a big risk. We don't want to upset the status quo. in search of freedom. It's an entirely different thing if Empire is directly ordering you to destroy the source of your potential freedom, because what's going to happen here is he's going to use the spacers to attack Foundation, and they know that Foundation has the ability to set them free. Are they willing to cut that lifeline?
No, it is interesting. And to the other point of like why she snapped judgment, I think you can make an argument that every second she considered his offer was 1 second the Empire would hold against her. And clearly that happened because like, even though within seconds, like what, within 2 minutes of being informed of the offer, she called the cops essentially. Empire still first question is, are the spacers against us now?
Yeah.
Were they tempted? So like,
even the temptation being out there is a threat. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a valid fear.
Yeah, it's exciting.
You see how
for the
brittle
future
that
story.
Makes people, right? Like, it's like amount of control you have, like where Bell's talking about, you know, weighing the cost of defiance versus not. That's a very strong hold, but it's very brittle because all you need is a few key people at key moments to be like, you know what, fuck this, and the whole thing crumbles down.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, tithing members of your family, essentially. You know, this is the Game of Thrones thing, right? Where like they, or the medieval thing, where they would have I played so much Crusader Kings 3, and now I can't think of the term. where you offer up a child to another house in order to secure a relationship,
hostage, and ward.
it's basically the hostage is what I'm getting at. There's this implied threat that if that alliance ever breaks down and you ever try and fuck us, we have your child. And it's a, you know, this is a strong control mechanism for sure. Is Shia Center going to want to attack a military that includes Shi Bin's light? I don't know. It's an extra wrinkle in the calculus, you know?
Damn. Yeah, so that's, I didn't even see that angle.
What is the term for that, man?
Isn't it ward?
A ward, yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you. Not a hostage. all right, let's move over to Bell and Glaewyn seeing the announcement from Day about ending the dynasty, and then Shi Bin's light calls them to review her findings from the Sawenna footage. The Home Swarm refuses Hober's offer because it's too risky, and then connects with Shi Bin's to say they have the Whisper ship, and then they jump the Home Swarm there to where Bell's ship is.
Yeah, and again, this thing just boiling out of the singularity is fucking jaw-dropping every time it happens.
Uh-huh. I mean, this instantaneous communication you talked about a minute ago is another incredibly valuable thing, I think, that they offer.
And they've kept from the Empire.
Right. Like, the abilities that they are displaying here that they are not sharing are wild.
Because they talked about how in their previous episode, the one spacer, the Constant, was talking about how they have continued to perfect and refine the genetic engineering. Who knows what host of abilities that they have added to themselves without the Empire knowing? Because, again, this is the brittle nature of the control, you know?
Totally.
Yeah, it's good stuff, and I like how they're setting up Bell and Glaewyn here, where it's like, you know, the central thing where Glaewyn's just afraid that Bell is going to be lost to the Empire. You know, he's going to be
and
consumed
he's reading
by
this
his
book, feet. Right? He's
that's all about, you know, essentially just war philosophy and whatnot, and
it's and that's going to play into a later scene here, which is really good between the two.
It's
of
amazing,
them.
Yeah.
Then the sighted ask Gail about the mule that she keeps thinking about, and she explains that she sees the future through her power and through psychohistory, and delivers an impassioned speech imploring all of the sighted to stop hiding so they can gather more sighted in preparation to fight the mule in 152 years. Seems like this is what Telem was hoping Gail would do, you know, take the reins here, start to work her way into the hearts and minds, literally.
Well, interesting that Gail did it tentatively. She like looked to Telem first, and Telem put on her "Go on, my child" face,
and then Telem looking over to Loran or whoever she looks at in the scene. Yeah,
It's good. It's a good speech. It also makes this seems like it's her theory. I don't know if it's something that Telem told her, but like the idea that like as the Empire begins to fall. And it seems like this is something Belle agrees with too. There's more and more pain, more and more chaos, more and more of these psychic screams, and that psychic pressure is pushing the sighted people to form together. You know, it's why there's sudden, like, there's a sudden spike of their numbers. And she's saying that we should intensify that. We, you know, this mule is not a inescapable future. It just means that we need to nudge, we need to mend things, we need to prepare. And she's advocating to stop hiding and boldly go out and say that we're sighted, so we draw more and more to our army, and we'll just be strong. We'll be ready for them. We'll be so, so much stronger.
Yeah.
And I love the juxtaposition of, like, well, we just need foresight, planning, and belief. And they cut over to Salvor, who is not on board with any of this.
Which is kind of ironic, because I think certainly in part this is to avoid the future where Salvor is dead. That is why Gale is kind of stepping up in this moment. It's also about the sighted, and it's also about, you know, securing a positive future for everyone, but it's maybe not primarily, but in good portion.
I think they're suggesting that Salvor's worried that it's primarily, that she's mortgaging the whole future on
to try and save her.
Desperate Hail Mary gambit to save Salvor at the expense of the Foundation project. Which I think she might believe in more than Gale even does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because she had a whole other generation of indoctrination. She didn't know anything before. This is the life she was born into.
Whereas Gale was actively fighting it earlier, so she's not as invested.
Felt like she got hijacked, regrets about whether she ever met Harry. Like, you know, Salvor doesn't have any of those.
Yeah, I think you're right. At least Salvor is worried that it's primarily for her benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to go over to back to Shea Center, who turns Hober over to Belle and Glaywin. They want him to show them how the Whisper Ship works. So he goes over to it. He pops open the door, and out comes Becky to rampage on their asses. He calls Becky back to the ship just in time to make his escape. And he is so close when he jumps to this ship that they think it's going to destroy their ship. But somehow it doesn't. It should have, it just doesn't.
Just gave him a trans-dimensional glitter bomb.
Yeah, it's a cool effect.
It is a cool effect. That actually
blown back. And
did you start thinking space psychosis?
Oh no, huh?
Like, they're, you know, because, like, that's like humans are not allowed within the singularity because it fucks up their shit, and that's a technical term. And they're right on the edge, and I wonder if they're going to play with the idea that this is going to have an effect on Belle or Glaywin.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I hadn't even considered it.
I sometimes I wonder, like, if Gale waking up was intentional to, you know, wasn't that one of her theories, to kind of awaken her psychic abilities? Or was just her waking up an indication to us that she has psychic abilities, because the space are like, what the fuck? You can't do this. Mm-hmm. Go back to sleep.
It might have been the latter.
Yeah.
But we find out that Shea Center is also Sheben's Light's mother, which is, I think, important.
Yeah, because it does show, like, they have a genuine, like, connection. There is this cost. This tithe does wound the, you know, like it would. Yeah, take 10% of your children. What the fuck?
Yeah, and she's personally invested in it. It's not just, you know, an abstract somebody else's children. It's that the seeming leader of the Home Swarm has personal investment here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got to say, when I'm seeing these spacers, I was thinking, like, I don't know how much of this is casting and how much of this is CG, but, like, oh man, if the Expanse could have done this with all the belters.
Oh yeah.
It's the only thing I can think of to make it, like, easily better. Like, if you could have these, like, otherworldly space, it'd been so cool. But, I mean, obviously they wouldn't be glowing and have half of their body mass missing, but, like, just the stretched outness of it. I don't know if this is natural, or if they're digitally altering these people to make them look a little bit taller and willowier, but they look incredible. It's a convincing effect. And also Becky, I've been wondering this whole time, like, why the fuck with Becky? Why would you do this? Why? But, like, as soon as he said, just something you should know about these Whisper ships, they have this crazy defense system, and yeah, it is badass.
Yeah.
And then right when it looks like it's going to rip Glaywin's face off, you hear it's like, good girl, Becky, come on. It's like, you know.
Yeah, he can't let Constance's pet stay here, right?
Yeah. I was worried that Becky might die. I was actually kind of genuine concern for her.
Yeah, me too.
Also, what and a name. Belle. What a name for this fucking thing, Becky.
Becky, yeah.
Oh my God, Becky. Look at this thing's claws.
Mm-hmm. Belle reports back to Day and Demerzel what he just saw the Whisper ship do. And that Hopper tried to tempt the spacers with promises of freedom. Belle thinks they're preparing for war because of all this. Day wonders if they hired the assassins, and Belle asks him, what are my orders now? But they cut the transmission before giving him any.
Really frustrates Belle. He's trying to be the dutiful soldier.
This kills me about Empire. I think it's Belle who says this. He says, Hober's from Smyrna, and therefore he must be speaking for the entirety of Smyrna in his reactions. It's like, you're going to hold, and we are, as a human here on Earth, we are so fucked if everybody did this when they met us. Be like, oh yeah, the first person, every single person speaks for Earth. No, it's not true. There's so many diverse opinions and peoples and
true
thinkings down here that you really need to take each one as individual.
Although, if I push back, in 10,000 years, if we are in a galaxy-spanning civilization, I do wonder if planets will become a little bit more, what's that word, provincial? Like, you know, like, it's sure. Like, yeah, you have difference of opinions, but, like, there are certain things that, like, all New Yorkers kind of agree on, or there's a certain effect, or, like, people from Dallas, L.A., right? Like, I could see a planet being so homogenous and travel so efficient and communication so ubiquitous that after 10,000, like, all of the differences, regional differences, just disappear. And, like, you might have difference between planets and sectors, but, like, yeah. But still,
maybe it's
Day's
over
a little
himself
impetuous here, maybe.
That he's so far off the map of, like, he's so far off the map of, like, what I would do in any given situation that I'm like, I wouldn't want him speaking for me. If he came from Earth, no, his actions don't reflect my thinking.
What if Smyrna is like a Han Solo planet where everyone's just dashing rogues?
Yes, okay, there we go.
That's their culture.
Whole planet of Hobers. I don't know if a show can handle Hober World.
Overworld coming soon to Delos Entertainment.
All right. This is big, but we're going to get to kind of some of the follow on effects from that scene. So let's keep going. Here's the big one. Here's a good scene. Glaewyn thinks that they should do something. Now they don't have orders. Belle's very reluctant to not just disregard the orders of Empire a second time, but act without orders, because that could be perceived the wrong way. And he lays out a scenario where, okay, what do you want to do, Glaewyn? You want to take down the entire Empire? All right, well, let's think about that. Where does that end? It ends in misery for trillions of people. And I have thought this through, and Glaewyn appreciates that. He's at least happy to hear that the Belle that he knows is still in there. He still cares. And he's thought through. He has a rationale that he's operating under.
Yeah, and I like the way this is filmed, like, as a physical contest or a sword fight, like it in like The Princess Bride, where these fighters are like ranging all over, like they're striding across. Like Belle tries to get away from Glaewyn, and Glaewyn, you know, forces the intimacy, and instead of being they're locked in struggle, but they end in like some kind of synergy rather than vanquishment, you know, like Glaewyn understands
he's not
where
sent away, he's drawn in. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like one of those things where it's like you can easily see both sides of this. Yeah. That's this authoritarian, this like what was that the phrase that Pablo Escobar used, the like Plato plomo or Plato? Yeah, like
yeah,
the silver
the
lead.
Or yes.
Like, that's such, like, because who is going to be the first municipal government official to be like, I'll take the lead, please.
Yeah.
But the second you find a motherfucker with a spine that can, your whole shit's up, man. So.
And what are the, you know, what's the fallout of that? And that's the thing that that Belle is really considering here. What is the fallout if we do succeed beyond our wildest expectations in attaining our goal? Because I think Belle wants to be some component of the Empire's downfall, or at least the Cleon's downfall, I would say. But he knows the consequences of that. Without order, you know, you get the 30,000 years of hell that Harry's been predicting.
And there's a lot of truth here. Like, when you're inside an empire, it seems like, you know, the temptation is to think that everything outside it is barbarism, because there probably is a fair amount of barbarism that the empire's order prevents. It's very similar to the Maximilian speech in, like, Gladiator, where he's like, I've seen the rest of the world. It's brutish and crude and dark. Rome is the light. You know, like, that's Bell's opinion on things. And you can understand where he comes from that.
Yeah.
But do you also see things like the foundation where it's like, it doesn't have to be that way?
Sure.
And of course, you know, there's an open question whether the foundation is an authoritarian regime at this point.
And the other side of the Empire's order is it's suffering that it's causing.
Right. Right. The fact that they're inflexible and they're not able to respond to people's needs.
And so, cruel.
They are cruel, uniquely cruel. And Belle knows that. That's so funny. Mm-hmm. It's like you hear this guy, like, talking about these, but, like, you yourself have had experienced unimaginable cruelty, and you know, you can, you know enough to imagine more cruelty that would come your way.
Yeah.
So it's just like, yeah, it's like, what do you do? And it's, I thought it's kind of interesting that Glaewyn seemed to be like, well, what about this foundation? Maybe we should give them a chance. I was surprised that Glaewyn didn't go with, like, you are the new Emperor, Belle. And I don't know whether they're going, whether they'll eventually get there, or this will be a tragic Glaewyn has to throw himself in front of some maniacal Belle to save the galaxy kind of gesture.
Yeah, it could go either way. I do wonder if Belle would want that responsibility and that level of involvement.
Did we talk about this? Did Belle want to? I find it hard to believe the guy that gave the speech that I'm the only one that stands between me and the suffering of the galaxy doesn't at least think he might do a better job.
Sure.
Especially if his best friend, lover, and co-combatant are pumping or gassing him up.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've talked about this, but this is something I heard off the official podcast, that when they cast the actor, and I don't have this in front of me, Belle Rios, that who they got for Glaewyn, they had just gotten with a long-running production. I wasn't sure if it was a stage show or if it was a series where they played lovers. So they have years worth of built-in chemistry that they can call on. And it's really, like, these are some touching scenes. Like,
nice.
You know, like, Belle, like, laying it all on the line to get Glaewyn to understand, and then the horror of, like, oh, God, I've made you... You know, it's like, well, now we're scared together. And Belle's like, shit, that's not what you really want for your loved one, but at least you're on the same page.
Sure.
It's good. It's good stuff.
It's Ben Daniels playing Belle and Dino Fetcher playing Glaewyn.
Thank you.
Give them some credit, because they're doing some great work here in this scene. I'm really impressed.
They really are. I can see Belle as an
not that they haven't before, but
I can see Belle as an interesting emperor to if you wanted to do with, like, an Empire and Civil War plot for next season, and he's like a main antagonist, protagonist, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely has a strong ethical core, which I think could be something I would value in an emperor.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We'll see. All right. Day meets with Sarith to tell her that he values her charisma with the public, and she decides now is a good time to talk about her family. She's fishing, and she tells him how kind and good all her dead family members were, and how young and innocent the baby boy was. And he sees what she's doing here and tells her, none of this is required. The only thing that I require of you is to say thank you for the opportunity that I'm presenting you with. And then, on the verge of tears, she leaves and tells her handman to get her a meeting with Dawn in private.
Is this the same garden? Is this the garden
first,
that Day brings his young women to just destroy their hopes and dreams?
Dude, first thing I thought is, this is the place where he murdered a woman's entire social circle, including her family.
Yeah, erased her.
Wiped her from the face of history. It was,
and left her nothing but individual torment.
It's such an amazing thing they've done here with this setting. because I'm immediately tensed up just seeing this little pool and the bench in the middle. Yeah.
If you had, so on a scale from Gossamer Court, what would you call this? Is this the Obsidian Garden? Like,
sure.
The least, the steel reflection pool. Like, it's nothing Gossamer about it, though. But yeah, it's cool. Because, like, there is something that's attracted to her. He sees that she's got the genuine goods, the thing that he spent a lifetime and 17 layers of genetic dynasty to try to ape poorly. She just, it comes natural to her, and he does admire that. He's like, I didn't think it's a surprise to him that he sees her. He is kind of seeing her as an equal, as a worthy partner.
Yeah, and, he really wants to.
And she blows it up. It's also, I think it's a nice little piece of writing that, they gave to Sereth here, that, you know, it's a very brief sketch of her family, but vivid. Like, I feel like I know her family members a lot better than I did before, and that's just with a sentence of color, and it's pretty archetypal stuff. Brother,
yeah, it's humanizing them, you know.
Yeah, you got the brother's the war hero, and the father's the patient teacher, and the mother's the, you know, seems aloof but devoted to her children, and it does double damage to Day, because he knows he doesn't have that in his, he doesn't have a family like that.
Sure.
None of these virtues that she has acquired, like flowers out of a garden of her family, and have put in her own breast to keep. He's got none of that shit. He's just like aping a ghost from hundreds of years ago.
And that's another reason why this scene is so good, is because Day doesn't have that. This is a perfectly tailored heartstring pulling discussion on someone who has the lived experience that, you know, Sereth does, or that I do, or you do, and us as humans with these reasonable feelings for other humans. Day doesn't have that. This is the miscalculation in this. She's giving away as much information, I think, as she's giving here. Or as she's getting here, right? She's confirming, did Day personally have anything to do with the murder of my family? Getting everything from him that says yes. But all of this stuff that she's trying to do to pull at him and push him in a different direction is like completely brick walled here. It just smashes straight into the sociopathy of this Day. And it's the line here, you are here by some uncanny combination of good fortune and my grace, and all that is required is that you say thank you. You say, I am grateful. And the way Lee Pace delivers this line,
so and good.
Who is playing Sereth? I have to look all this stuff up. The way that she responds to it, Ella Ray Smith responds to it, is just, it's perfect. It's perfect. You realize that you have reached an impasse between the two that is unresolvable.
Yeah, and I think the Day might be making a mistake here. It's like, well, you might have heroics and valor and patience and kindness and humility, but I'm fucking ruthless, baby. I think that's a mistake a lot of tyrants make, that decent people can't get to that bottom. Can't be every bit of a vicious fighter for survival. Like, that's the mistake of authoritarian regimes going against so-called softer cultures time and time again. And like from the next scene, it's like where she's talking about
that connection that powers them.
And when she gives that bloodless coup speech, you can see she's every bit as ruthless.
Yes,
but a lot more directed and scalpel-like in the lack of ruth that she displays.
Yeah, it doesn't shut her down. It pushes her to go around you. I mean, the thing she's about to do is an end run around the stone wall that she just hit, you know? She's not going to give up. She's just going to find another way.
And the thing I got, because I watched this a couple times, and I think that, like, with the overwhelming feeling Day was feeling here was shame. Like, she was shaming him with what he did just to get this opportunity and what he took away. And that echoes back to what Rue says, the one thing you can't do to a man who simultaneously doesn't see you as a threat but also is, you know, amused with you, is you can't embarrass him or make him feel You can't humiliate him. And you can see instantly she's
done it in public now and now in person privately, emotionally.
But this is the most direct attack on, like, you're a fucking monster. You disgust me. Like, it's been kind of playful, like, maybe.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. 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 It's hell of a response day.
It sure is. You have correctly judged me. What are you going to do about it? So then the end run here is Dawn and Sarath meet secretly. She tells him that Day and Dimmersdale killed her family and tells him how different he is from his brother, asks if she can have his baby instead, and spends a couple minutes seducing him with the concepts of sex and legacy, and they kiss. This is, I guess, a yes from Dawn.
I want to head off some feedback because I think there might be a couple people are tempted to be like, oh, the face scramblers, if they're that shitty, they stop working randomly and fade in and out.
Not what's happening here. Yeah.
I think you're supposed to understand that this is like the scene in Red October where Sean Connery's speaking Russian and it zooms in on his lips and then he starts speaking English, it zooms out. It's like, probably just saving budget.
Yeah, instead of, he hasn't just learned, like, English in that moment, right? He's now, we're just understanding what he's saying when he's speaking Russian.
Yeah, it's like you're supposed to understand that inside the field, maybe just so we can identify that, and you can actually have the actors that you paid a bunch of money emote their scenes. But like, I think everyone else looking at them is seeing the doubles. So it's not malfunctioning technology like the Predator's cloak with damage. It's just, it's a filmmaking technique. So I'm glad we're both aligned on that.
Here's one thing with that. When he starts talking about the Kleons and in first person terms here, somebody's walking past them in the cloak. I'm not sure that's not a spy down here in the oculi free zone.
Yeah. And you wonder. Yeah. Cause like what if they make sure they tell all 17-year-old emperors that, just so they know where they can go to plat so that they can extra listen to it. Yeah. There's a lot going on here. I wondered that myself, but I also thought that, like, the facial scanners probably disguise their voice. But he does say in Kleonic,
he's saying it in, like, first-person terms here.
The dude that saw them kind of looked at him funny, but it might just be that they're not, these people are strange faces, or he doesn't, I don't know
maybe I'm just biased because I watched the latest episode of Justified City Primeval. And that has a scene very similar in its characters judging people walking by.
Yeah.
And
I
so I'm thinking, I'm just on alert for that stuff.
But this is a pitch that's aimed at every level of his being, like the nascent ambition that probably all Dons have to feel, like, especially this. Like, I like this is that this is all of the characters and like the primes. Like, this isn't a little boy. This is the Dawn that's like, what, 19, 20? You got Day that's in his late 40s, probably. And like, Dusk is not like decrepit, like he's about ready to become brother. But like, they're all at their most powerful versions of themselves. And you got to think that like a Dawn gets in his 20s and he starts thinking, yeah, I'm next, baby. So she's appealing to his ambition. Like, you're going to be nobody. Don't you want to cast a shadow? She's appealing to his hormones. Like, wouldn't it be super fucking hot if you knocked me up before your brother could? And she's appealing to his, like, his need to individuate, to like defy Day. It's a compelling argument. Do you think it works? Do you think he's going to agree to it?
I mean, the kiss says yes. There were a couple of alarm bells ringing in my head.
Well, sure, this is dangerous. This is all so fucking dangerous.
Well, it's not that. It's around, I guess, the writing in this scene. I'm remembering what Dusk was saying about memory when they discover, you know, that memories may have been altered. He says, you know, what young men, when you get old enough, you stop worrying about what you remember and worry about how you're remembered. And a large portion of her pitch here to this young man, it's about legacy. And I feel like that would work strongly on Dusk, but I don't know that it works as strongly on Dawn. Now, she has the 1-2 punch of, hey, we can bang, and that would be awesome. And so I think, like, that works on the young man pretty damn effectively. Hell, it might work on Dusk, too, judging by what I've seen of him. But that combined with her discussion of like, she really stresses, oh, your seed could be the one true heir. And yeah. it hits on that legacy thing, right?
And how would they even know you're genetically identical? Which I don't even know is true, but...
Well, the idea of one true heir, I think, is faulty here. It's not... Look, they had this discussion earlier on. They were saying, you know, what you're giving up so much in the security of the clone dynasty. How are you guaranteeing that you perpetuate your dynasty? And Day is like, we'll have 1 million kids, you know? We can do it with a whole bunch of children.
But still, that firstborn, unless they're going to do some kind of really crazy way of succession, that firstborn will probably sit the throne if he lives.
Sure. And he will be the one true heir as long as he lives. And that's what I... That,
See,
that's
this is
the
where
thing
Day...
That,
this is where Day closes. He makes sure he snaps the firstborn's neck. Because that could have been one of the other brothers.
True. Yeah.
But now we got the eggs in the lab, and I'm going to guarantee, yeah.
I don't know. I was feeling the weight of previous conversations going, is this actually going to work on Day? And does this make sense with everything I know about the arrangement thus far? And I mean, so a lot of this, so all of this is couched in, I'm trying to put up the best possible case to Dawn to go through with this. And so a lot of what she's saying can't be taken at face value. She knows she's going to have a bunch of children, right? But that first one, if you can get in there in time, that'll be the one true heir. Don't think about the other seven and the danger that the one true heir would have hanging over his head at all times.
But it'd be almost be like just a secret. Like only her and Day would know, or only her and Dawn would know. But
yeah,
it's like what something that might make it into history books. So it's like something she whispers to the kid as she died. I don't know. It'd be fascinating to see it play out, which we might. We might start come back next season and we see these fucking brats on the throne with an old ass, you know.
And it makes sense in the way that like Dawn has to have been thinking about the loss that he's going to suffer if this marriage goes through, because he's losing his opportunity to be a part of this legacy and losing the opportunity to rule. But through a child, he might find some, you know, second best sort of thing here.
Yeah, it's probably smart that they're keeping this kind of like loosey goosey, but like I'm always hungry for more world building. Like, how is this new empire going to work? Because I noticed that Day thinks there's going to be 4 thrones on the dais. So like what happened? Like, so what does Dusk die and then there's 3 and then you die and there's 2 and like what?
He's keep removing a throne. Yeah.
He's going to let those brothers live out their natural lives. Because like I said, Dawn especially is a threat. Like, you know, we talked about this a lot. So yeah, I wish I knew how they intended the brothers, but maybe that's a little sinister. The reason that there isn't a obvious thing for them to do is because Day's planning on eliminating them. And I could see him doing that. He seems to kind of like hate his other brothers.
Yeah, they're definitely not the one man that the first Kleon would want them to be.
Yeah. But those guys strike me as, for whatever reason, more Kleon than him. He's had to have a lot of work done, and he's the... Yeah.
Yeah, except for those scenes where he has to tell somebody, you exist by my grace, say thank you. That feels very Kleon to me. All right, let's go over to Constant and Polly. They get taken before the Kleons. Polly begins his sales pitch, which amuses Day. He accuses them of offering peace while fomenting rebellion. And Constant turns into Harry and tells Day that they've come to offer peace because they know that if there were war, Foundation would win. And Day says his predictions are out of date because the Kleonic dynasty is ending. And then he orders Terminus be sacked and their technology taken. And Polly and Constant are taken away.
Couple things up front. Did you check out Brother Constance cot stance? How next level her laying down on a cot game is?
I didn't notice. Is it anything like Day laying on a bed trying to impress someone?
No, it's like if someone said to this woman, I need you to have the lowest energy, most bored position a human body can take. Like I want to look like I filled your like a liquid measuring glass with your body and I just poured it out onto the cot like a skillet. It's hilarious. It's like some kind of Froggy style It's wild. So that's number one. So one is if people want to go check out the funniest way a human being can lay on a cot. Second, how about Day's new armor?
Yeah, yeah.
Goyer kind of prepped us for this, but it's a noticeably darker color. It's much more medieval, and that there's like some golden chainmail. Just a little bit more obviously less ceremonially militant.
Mm-hmm. And it's a divergence from the clones, right?
Right, because they still got divergence the dynasty. Yeah, they still have their regular things, it looked like to me.
Yeah.
That's cool. I mean, this is another great sparring situation.
Yeah.
I love how Polly was working it when, they're talking about absurd. You're an imperial outpost, you're property, not a partner. And he's like, oh, such similar words, property, partner.
Yeah, what Day doesn't account for here is the unreliable nature of Harry's comments. Because Harry has intentionally lied to people in the past to get them to do what he wants. To assert that, oh, Harry's predictions are out of date and useless because the Kleonic dynasty is changing is, if you knew Harry, on the face of it, ridiculous.
But you can see how Empire would say it, because this guy studied up Harry and he said, you can't ever change and this is a fatal flaw of your dynasty. And Cleon's like, I'm fixing it. I'm doing exactly what you said might put the brakes on it. And Harry's like, nah, fuck you. We got jump ships and weapons and...
Well, he doesn't know the Harry that's an obvious liar either, right? Like, the Harry that he's studying is the guy who has had a strong and outspoken belief in psychohistory in the way that he predicts it, and he said that this thing is going to happen. But then he's lied to his own people in order to get them to do the things they want, and he doesn't know that, Harry.
Well, so, like, is that a weakness, the fact that he didn't tell Polly? Or is it the effect of Polly reeling from the cross purposes that they set out? Because, like, now we understand what that meant by cross purpose. Suing for a non-aggression pact, or no, an aggression pact, a kick in the nuts Empire pact with their number one linchpin trading partner. Obvious prelude to an act of war. Versus suing for peace and diplomatic rep. So it's like that, like, made sense. But, like, it feels like Empire used this as a way to stunt, of be like, look at how you were manipulated and you keep your elder in the dark and you manipulate women. And it feels to me like this is something that Harry wanted to happen.
That's the thing. I look at all of his plans crumbling on the face of it and I go, what does he have up his sleeve? Because I know he's got something.
Yeah. And we talked last week about, the strengths of showing versus telling. And how, like, the show is very... There's two insets here. One that I felt was vital and one that I want to talk about. The one was this shot where just as Harry's about to pop out of Constant, they show Harry kissing her head. I think that's pretty necessary, because I think a lot of people would be like, what the fuck is happening? Had they not reminded them of, like, some, we don't know what the kiss
physical
did,
interaction.
But it's something. Yeah.
That's what I was asking earlier. Like, what is the mechanism here? But it's, indistinguishable from magic, so I don't know.
Right. He's inserting something into her head or whatever. What did you think about the insets of Dusk when he goes, you're keeping your elders in the dark and you're manipulating women, and they pan from dark to Dimmerzell, these inset shots. Do you think that... added, because I was curious. Again, this is not a huge criticism, but I wondered how that would play if you didn't and just let people come to those conclusions. Because that's the thing, it's like, in trying to lay bare Harry's hypocrisy, Day is essentially pointing all three fingers back at himself.
Right, there's that rich context here. I like it. I will be honest, I kind of needed those things in this scene.
Okay. The kiss, I think, would be a lot of head scratching without it. There'd be a lot of how the hell, but like that, at least we don't know how the hell, but like it somehow grounds it enough that like it's fine. But I think I agree with you. I like the pan to a Taris's face and the Bryn's face, but there's a burn. God damn it.
Reaction shots are super important.
It is.
Give so much context without actually having to say it.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a weird of where things are both simultaneously showing and telling you. It's not an either. It's not an or. It's an and.
Yeah, but sometimes they're telling different things when they're showing. You know, it's yeah. It's yeah. I like it.
And Day describes his own behavior as a violation, essentially.
I guess I want to talk about what could Harry's plan here be? Because I look at all the moving parts of it, right? He's sending out his missionaries to go and treat them for peace. And then he's also sending Hober out there to foment rebellion and try and take away a critical component of their military. And I wonder if he's thinking win-win on this with Hober. He sends Hober out, and she a center just says, yep, okay, cool. Empire can't move. Empire is crippled. I mean, without jump ships, there's no way to fight Foundation. It would take forever for them to reach Foundation with a military, let alone a military that's not that's going to be advanced enough to fight whatever Foundation is coming up with in the meantime. And the other situation is they don't accept, and then they force this war that they are prepared for, that they say they will win if it happens. They're baiting them into war.
Oh, 100%. They want to provoke a war. A defensive war is probably easier for them to win, and ultimately they also want the moral high ground. We didn't attack Empire. Empire came for us. We wanted peace, but the two juxtaposed positions would make that impossible.
And what does Empire do? Say, well, they tried to take away our spacers. We tried to give them their freedom. That's justice.
Right.
Isn't that what you want?
You can see how they could sell that. You can see how they could start selling that. Yeah. So I think it's a win-win. Like, if they get peace, then that gives them even more chance to build up their power and subsume the Empire. If they go right to war, then they have the moral high ground. They have superior technology, and they have the defender advantage. So come get it.
Yeah. It's an interesting strategy. I think an effective one. Even in the face of, like, everything seems to be crumbling around Harry.
Yeah. And I also like to note that the Day goes back to some semi-ancient knowledge about sending a thespian bearing a gift. Your prophets put you in an ugly position. Like, yeah, that's how the shit started sliding in the first place.
Yeah. And Harry's not above putting people in ugly positions.
Nope. But I think Costa can argue from any of them. I'm actually shocked because as this was happening, I'm like, oh God, I killed Constant. I actually said this is the thing that might happen and I don't want it to happen. I was actually kind of surprised that she survived the Emperor Palpatining she got.
Me too. Oh, I was looking forward to coming here and rubbing that failed theory in your face. Like, see, I told you, Constant, they're never going to see each other again because she's dead. Nope, she survived it somehow.
Yeah, I'm glad we had strong emotions about that scene, both of us.
It's only by the good fortune and grace of Empire that she survived that encounter.
And you know what? I'm grateful.
All right, let's go over to Salvor, checking out the ship that returned, the boat that returned suspiciously, to see where its logs say it went. Gale comes up, asks what she's doing. Salvor tells her, this boat went somewhere, I need to figure out where. And Gale tells her, it's not the time to start pulling threads. I'm doing something here. Just trust me.
Is it possible that Gale is actually Tenem in this scene?
Oh, ho, ho. Yes, it's certainly possible.
It's nothing that Gale hasn't said before, though I would also be an interesting question to consider how many times Gale in this episode could have been Tenem.
Let me ask you this.
This is the way more stronger and directive speech than she gave in the first episode. And that could be just because she's more desperate to get Salvor to fucking listen to her. But it also could be that, you know, because like...
Doesn't Tenem specifically say, to specifically mention the idea of pulling threads?
I was going to ask you this, and that was going to be my hammer if you did. And on the next one, it's like, isn't it interesting they both use the same phraseology?
Yes.
Now, Tenem's a mind reader. So you always have that, but I thought
I thought
that was something that they may be putting intentionally in there as some evidence.
She might have just read that out of Gail's mind, because they don't use the filter in the next scene that you would expect, or sorry, in the scene that you would expect if this were
right.
Tell him.
That's the big, but, and I don't know how consistent they've been on this. And again, this could be Goyer's new stupidest thing the guys have ever said on the podcast edition, but I couldn't have, especially when I heard her say
he's
the
marking
thread
this,
line.
He's writing this down for the next time he talks to us.
Yeah, this is the one thread you can't pull. I'm like, that's such a, and then the second time I watched it, I just like, man, Gail is being really just shut the fuck up and get in line in a way that I guess I could buy, but also feels very flattering to tell him.
Well, I guess that's the thing. Assuming it's not tell him, it's actually Gail. She's effectively saying, I am trying to take over the Sighted. I'm trying to usurp it. I'm trying to save your life is what she's basically saying here. Right. And you're getting in the way of that.
Yeah.
But it could also be Tell Him.
It could also be Tell Him.
And then the final scene is Salvor, you know, being Salvor, can't get this off her mind. She can't sleep that night, so she goes out to the boat. This is classic Salvor.
Patrolling.
Can't sleep. Yep, I'm getting out there. She uses the boat to go to where it was the previous night, the navigation cache. And she arrives at the place where Harry was murdered and finds his body still shackled in the water. And then Tellum shows up, says, I'm sorry you saw this, and then turns off her mind, leaving her floating face down in the tide pool.
I just composed a song that Tellum could sing based on Rolling Dirty. They see me floating, they hating, patrolling, trying to catch me drowning Harry.
Okay.
Anyway, I heard less than half what you said because that was going on inside the cacophony of my mind.
I was just recapping it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, she goes, she finds Carrie's corpse. Tellum says, you pulled the unfortunate thread, and she essentially
unthinks her mind, and now she's unbreathing oxygen, face down in the water.
So... another thing I was flirting with when I was coming up with my notes is, what if we are going to understand that Tellum's actually separated all three? She split Harry off of the two, and then in this episode, and we didn't fully understand that until later when we saw Harry drowning in the pool. This episode, she splits Gail from Salvor, and every instance of Gail talking to Salvor is actually Tellum.
Okay. I mean, that's absolutely a possibility.
Or it happened at some point in this episode, because the only thing that's like I don't like about that is like Gail, I think, was pretty Gail in like when she was giving that speech to everybody.
And I mean, what do you make of Loran saying like she values your abilities much more than you think? And then this
I don't
happening.
Know, because I don't understand what her abilities are that aren't just like a lesser version of Gail's, like a backwards version of Gail's. But maybe there's some kind of crazy judo that you can apply to that.
Yeah, I mean, here's the other thing. So Salvor's not dead. She's just unminded face down in the water. They can wade in there and grab her and then, you know, preserve her abilities. They don't have to kill her here, right?
So is this like a threat? Like, this is your last warning? Like, this is what I can do anytime? But, like, She goes back and tells Gail that. Is Gail still going to be pretty circumspect about trusting?
I mean, you have to hold her now, right? You can't let her have contact with Gail if this is your option here. You have to, like, break her first.
Mm-hmm. Or keep her split off and just psychically replace her with somebody else.
Right,
which
right.
they can do. Even someone you know intimately, like Hugo.
There's a lot of possibilities. This doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the jumping the shark moment of deaths that Goyer was talking about in our interview.
Yeah. Like I said, I was like, one of the biggest evidence of this not being that is like he was so fucking confident knowing we're going into this episode.
Right.
Like, and I thought
they've done this before and not killed any of them. Right. They've unthinked their minds and then just snapped them up and kept them in the palace or whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's a lot of ways out of this. But it's one of those things where I want to hit play next. I want to just keep watching, so I think it's really effective.
Yeah, that's the thing. We're essentially in the same boat as y'all. We're just like time shifted 1 week in the future where we can't talk to anybody except each other about it.
Right.
So it's a lot of willpower, it turns out.
Mm-hmm. But that's it for the episode.
Yeah,
man.
That's all I got. If you'd like to send feedback to Foundation, don't forget we still have an opportunity to talk to David S. Goyer at the end of the season. He's agreed to another wrap up. So if everything goes smoothly like that, we should make that happen. If you are sending in that feedback, make sure you put in the word Goyer, G-O-Y-E-R, in the subject line somewhere so I can find it easily.
You're listening to Foundation and Podcast. We'll be right back. And we're back. Respect and enjoy the podcast.
First up with feedback is Craig from the UK. He says, one character I find immensely unique and undefinable is Demerzel. I really can't quite get it if she's working for or against the Empire. Obviously, that's the hope of the writers, but come on, most of the time an audience can suss out who the bad from the good is. For example, you got Severus Snake. He's painted as a bad guy, but we all knew he was secretly good. Did we know that in the second or third? I'm trying to figure out when we knew that for sure. Probably the end of the third movie. But Demerzel is an enigma. I'm not sure if it's my personal bias, but I cannot shake the feeling she's working against the Empire. We are told she's been programmed to be loyal, and we're seeing her protecting Empire, but she's also shown to have some free will. She's having a religion she believes in, and I find it hard to believe you could happily serve an Empire that slaughtered your race and now keeps you in servitude. For such a long-lived entity, she may have found small ways she can manipulate events and people to finally bring down Empire. Also, the seemingly throwaway line that her consciousness is dispersed may not mean throughout her body, but in many other bodies, and those bodies don't have the same face, such as Callie, for example. Got a few people suggesting in feedback that Callie might be an AI. I don't know if the timelines... I didn't know Callie was that ancient. I thought she was a couple thousand years ago, not like from the time when robots walked the Earth, but, or I guess strode the galaxy. What do you think about the, contradictions that are Demerzel?
I'm enjoying them. I think, yeah, that's a central question, right? The writers are definitely playing with that. Is she, and I wouldn't even say, is she good or bad, but where do her loyalties lie? Cause like, let's remember the Cleonic dynasty is not good. It's bad. It always has been. Even from the start, the very concept is offensive, I think. Does she serve the Empire or does she have her own agenda? And I'm with you. I think the show is shading it to she might have some kind of agenda of her own. I think they're definitely in kind of inserting that idea into viewers' heads.
Yeah, and the idea that she is, like, ultimately the executor of the will of Cleon the First, it seems. That's really interesting. And I really like what Goyer said in the episode we had with him where, you know, it's like not that three laws don't exist and they were even name-checked in this episode, correct?
Yes, they were.
But, like, the robots can be reprogrammed. And I wonder if some of the psychosis we've seen Demerzel face is the shoddy reprogramming of those systems. And there still is some conflict between those rules and the new one that is Protect Empire. Like none of this is a thing and she's been like protecting Empire is how she's interpreting what is sometimes called the Zeroth Law of Asimov's robots, that they can't allow humanity in total to come to harm if they can't help it. So like I said, I'm not sure about the Kale theory, but like I said, my money is that she's not a bad or evil thing. That if you understood the path she's been walking for 13,000 years, you'd probably agree with it. But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know why I think that.
Yeah, there's nothing to really say that. But I do believe that they will, you know, they have an idea firmly in mind for her past and her motives, and they will in due time tell us what that is. So it's very much intentional. I'd be worried if, or I'd be more dismayed, I guess, with it if it didn't feel intentional. But everything they're doing with her feels very intentional.
Yeah, and I got a lot of buy, because like when I think of Asimov robots, I don't think of like bloody-minded psychotic individuals. I usually think that they're, you know, well-meaning, congenial servants who are trying to do their best to serve us filthy apes, you know? Mm-hmm. So like having her just like doing something for her own glory or her own, like, people would be a surprise to me, but also would be a somewhat welcome one, because I wouldn't mind seeing robots being explored in that direction.
Gotcha.
And as long as they are like, you know, again, like, it's not that it would be weirder for me if Demerzel was doing things like killing people and just like completely nonchalant about it, but it's obviously acting against her religious people that mean a lot to her religiously, acting against the days and dawns of the world, acting against her own religious beliefs. These are all things that are causing her some cognitive distress, it appears.
Mm-hmm.
Steven says, there's one thing that I haven't really heard you guys dive into in season two, and that's Demerzel's religion. My theory is that Demerzel's mission changed after Day made her murder Halima. I think she knew that Day did have a vision, or did not have a vision in the Salt Cave, and because of her religious beliefs, this led her to understand that the Kleons are not real people. So she set and planned a motion that would allow her to remove the Kleons and save the Empire while also exacting some measure of revenge. That's why she's able to so easily kill the defective Dawn last season. I also wonder if the supposed lack of a soul has something to do with the memory disparity between the real Kleons and the clones. What do you think about this? You think she just has a moral revulsion to the Kleonic dynasty now?
I'm trying to remember if she... Was there any reason to think... Did they just flat out say it, maybe? Did Day, like, confess to her that he didn't have a vision? I can't remember how that all resolved.
Didn't he copy hers down to the letter, and she realized that he plagiarized hers?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's becoming more plausible as we talk about it. Because that would be fairly offensive to her. But is that enough to rewrite the rules, right? Because the way she describes it now is that she was reprogrammed. She used to serve the three laws. Now she serves Empire. That must have happened, I assume when Kleon the First, you know, commissioned her on this thing.
In that like second or third episode of the first season where old ass Kleon the First was reviewing like the final construction details of the space bridge, and she was talking mm-hmm. about how the systems programmers are finishing their upgrades, and we even at the time wondered if they were talking about Demerzel or the systems on the star bridge, because it's very ambiguous, and it seems like now it seems like the latter, that maybe this isn't an antiquity that her programming was altered, but like more recently.
I think so. That's the vibe I'm getting. So does she
maybe
have
it was altered
capacity?
At the end of the robot war by the Empire, and then it was altered at the beginning of the genetic dynasty to serve the personification of Empire?
Perhaps. I'm curious, to see what ability she has to alter her own drives, I guess.
Right. Can she be her own? Because
her mind? Can she be offended by, you know, Day's treatment of her religion and get offended and change her programming? I don't know.
And it's like, she's so inscrutable too. I was just thinking about, like, can you imagine being in a relationship with a person like this? It's like, hey, you had a hard deck. I cooked your favorite food, lasagna. And she's like, oh, yes, lasagna, my favorite food. As she, you know, she has a look of crushing disappointment just enter the edges of her eyes, you know.
You ask her like, hey, did you did you go by the post office and establish a new account for us today? And she says, I did my tasks as required. Like, that's not a direct answer.
I am loyal
to
the post office. Did you actually slick the stamp though? And you know, every time, like, we've debated about what she means when she says Empire, but you go all the way back, like the Kleonic dynasty is just the last bit of the empire that stretches back for thousands of years. So mm-hmm. she could literally be talking about the pre-Cleonic concept of the empire on Trantor.
Sure.
And not the Cleonic clone dynasty in particular. So just there's a lot of wiggling in these rooms that they've made.
Yeah, I mean, it's the biggest thing I want to know about Demerzel. What are her loyalties? I hope we get a little bit more information about that this season.
Lucas says, I hope they touch on this at some point, but when Cleon talked about no one remembering why the stadium was originally built, it made me wonder if you can just decant clones and they have all their memories right up until insert bad death event, whatever. Why didn't the OG Cleon just keep passing down his memories to each subsequent clone, effectively resulting in immortality? Not that this was best served the story, obviously, just hoping there was an in-universe explanation for it that I missed.
I mean, he did pass down a subset. Right. I mean, the whole revelation of like he has three times the memory of us is shocking because we always thought he did pass down all those memories directly. Right.
No, I guess I thought that they decant the Dawn. It's a baby. And that Dawn is raised by Day, Dusk and Demerzel to be the next, like, instructed like a child. Like, I don't I never thought that there was like flash clone memories, even though they're clearly technologically capable of it. I guess is because why did they call themselves exponents rather than I'm still Cleon? I'm just every 30 years I get a younger body. Like, here's my headcanon. I think that Cleon identified a number of weaknesses in a hereditary dynasty, and he wanted to come up with a new form of government that had all the strengths of the former, you know, way of government, but none of its weaknesses in terms of messy succession. And the idea, instead of like identically cloning someone, that by training them, that would be like a way to optimize the ruler. You know, like as the galactic conditions change, you don't need the same person. And being raised in these changing galactic conditions by people who are changed by the galaxy gives them enough flexibility that they would be the ultimate dynasty. You'd never need to replace it. Because it feels deliberate.
I guess that's not how I interpreted it. What we've been seeing, I thought all the memories were passed down.
So you think that every Cleon has every Cleon's memories, or just the first one that they start with? You're born as an infant with all
the knowledge.
Guess
that doesn't
make
a lot of sense given the numbers we saw, huh? Because like each of them wouldn't have 80 something; they'd have 80 something plus.
You know, yeah, they wouldn't have a subset.
Be exponentially, or not even exponentially, but they'd
each
be
one would have a little bit
growing,
bigger of a file. Yeah. Yeah.
So okay, yeah, I need to change because I was always under that assumption this entire time. So I guess I need to update that. In my brain.
So it's got to be a cultural, not a technological. It's got to be something that this is the way Cleon wanted it set up. Not obviously not because you couldn't transfer memories into clones.
But that's crazy because you're wanting to set one thing in stone, but you're wanting the other to evolve. That's weird. You want to set the genome of these people. You want to have the exact identical person physically in charge, but not give them the same mentality.
Do you think it was a political compromise? Like he would rather just be the eternal leader, but he knew that the elites of the galaxy and the common people would bulk against that. So having the genetic component to like, we got 30 years of this guy and then we'll have a slightly different version. And they do seem different. They're not like, there's no continuity of personality.
I always thought resulted from the genetic drift, right? The reveal that they've been, you know, the original has been tainted and we're all less than or
different.
Yeah, it's
tough because
we
never got to see a full cycle of Cleon's uncorrupted. It would have been interesting to see at least one phase of that because, you know, all the Cleons have their own little epitaph, you know, the dreamer, the painter, the engineer, the builder. To me, that shows that there were subtle differences even before they started genetically drifting.
Yeah, that would make sense.
I don't know what
the purpose of that is within this dynasty, though. Like, why set it up that way?
Yeah.
Whether it's a political concern, whether it's like a just a structural concern, a longevity thing. Like, you can't have the same person ruling because it'll just crumble eventually. I don't know.
I will say I think that they do have answers to this, and they'll probably get to it because, you know, they've referenced the... They've had a couple tantalizing set scenes of Cleon the First. One in the Principatorium we saw, or Principium, whatever it is, the Hall of Memories. And the other one when we actually saw him with Demerzel at the start of the Genetic Dynasty. And they always refer to the plan, you know? And we've never been told
the memory
plan
stock,
is.
Right?
Yeah, I feel like we're headed towards getting big answers.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
So I'm not saying that you have to trust us to, like, oh, it's a complex cultural technological. I think that they'll give us solid answers. Rob in Versailles, or I guess if it's in Southern Indiana, it's for sales. When Day makes a speech about Queen, is it the Empress Gwyneset being forgotten before unveiling the statue, the camera focuses from Day to Demerzel. The collar of the statue also looks a lot like Demerzel. Is there any chance that Demerzel is modeled after Gwyneset? And is that why she's pulling all the strings? I don't think so, because Demerzel is 13,000 years old and came way before this queen. Now, if you're suggesting that Cleon had relations with his robot and made her empress, is that what he's suggesting, maybe?
And
I would say, like, I would have a hard time believing that people wouldn't recognize Demerzel as, like, wait, don't you look like the old empress? But in Cleon the 16th day, they have all forgotten her. But that wouldn't have been the case in Cleon the 2nd, 3rd, 4th day. So
her, like, cloistered in the Imperial Palace, right? I don't think anybody... Yeah, I don't know. The people who are, I guess, high up in political structures would notice.
And that's a big deal.
That's important, yeah. But the public,
let me ask you this: can Demerzel change her face? She can repair it. She can regrow it from nothing.
I assume. Yeah, why not?
I do too. I wonder if at some point they change Demerzel to look like the Empress or something.
It's possible, because that's what I was getting at. Like, did they change her programming only, or did they change her look to reflect, you know, the mother of Cleon the First, or whatever she would have been, right?
And Day just changed his look this episode, so it's like, why couldn't Demerzel at some point start wearing clothes that were reminiscent of, you know, the empresses? Because she's kind of that role. She's the mommy.
It's possible. It's possible, but, you know, a lot of this is... All this right now is so much speculation because we just don't know enough about Demerzel yet.
Accordingly, episode 9 is going to give us a lot of answers. We'll have to hold out till then.
Mm-hmm.
Fred from Newburgh, New York. Tellum is the best character that I absolutely hate. Tellum's cult leader vibes are very strong. I described her to a friend as having big 1970s New Age California death cult vibes. Like, I'm pretty sure she'll be in a Netflix documentary soon. She also nails the Magneto outlook of smug superiority and separateness. About that. I think it's interesting that people like Tellum go through this strong negative experience with the majority, where they're a minority that's been preyed upon or put upon. It seems like in the case of, like, Magneto and Tellum, when they go through these experiences, they come out of there convinced of their own, like, moral righteousness. Like, going through that intense crucible, like, changes the way they see ethics and morality. It's like, well, if the one side can just hunt us like animals and, you know, kill us for sport, then maybe drowning one of them to save hundreds and thousands of us isn't the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, they are able to do some moral calculus that comes out in favor of their worldview that maybe I wouldn't do.
But you haven't done the math.
The bully.
You've never been forced to do that long division.
Yeah. It's the bully becoming the bullied becoming the bully kind of thing, right?
Because they're terrified to be put in that position again. Mm-hmm. And if they can ever help it, they'll never allow themselves to be victimized again, even if they have to victimize others to keep that from happening.
Yeah, and it's sort of a romanticizing of their own finer qualities, I guess. Like, oh, well, I'm not like that. You know, when I'm in power, I will make sure that this stuff that was done to me is never done. But in the meantime, I need to do it because the ends justify the means.
I'm not like the other tyrants. Fred has a long shot prediction. Tellum is the mule. I noticed the mule seems very powerful in Gale's vision, strong enough to maintain an illusion like that. I've got no idea, but I've been wondering when we'll first meet the mule for real, and not just a glimpse in the future. Hiding a shark like that would be a heck of a reveal later. I'm definitely wrong, but hey, long shot bets are the ones that pay huge when they hit. What odds would you give Fred here on Tellum being the mule?
I've wondered about this too. I think it's a natural thing to wonder when you see her powers.
And we see consciousness start shifting through technological vessels, through different bodies, and yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she says she's sick, I think. She says she's not well or ill or whatever she says. But so what if you can just hop in a cryopod in 150 years from now? You know, you get chemo, your hair drops out, and you don the goggles and start coming after Gale. I think this is a very real possibility.
I mean, some people are going to say, well, there's the physical resemblance isn't there at all, but like...
Well, she look at what they did with Hugo. That wasn't... I'm leaning toward... All of my thinking around this, like, it kind of started there. Like, maybe Tellum's the mule. And now I'm starting to think maybe the mule isn't real. Maybe the mule is just an idea planted into Gale's head by Tellum.
Because even the damage the mule did to Gale's body was something that Gale's mind did. So you could have a psychic manifestation of a villain that can do everything that a villain can, and it's just not real.
Yeah.
It could crush people's windpipes. It can shoot guns out. Yeah. Huh.
I have nothing to actually support that, really. No positive evidence to point to, but the potential is certainly there. So I'm keeping my eye on it.
It seems... Like, I never thought about this before, but it seems now that he's going down this path, it seems very tidy from a show-making position to for us to already have met the mule.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, it's like, we don't know it yet. It might be the kid with the scarred face. It might be the kid where it's got the no, there is no spoon vibes. It might be Tellum. It might be one of her other mm-hmm. acolytes. It might be Gale. That would be kind of, or Salvor. That would be kind of interesting. I don't think it can literally be that because I don't know how you strangle yourself and demand to know where your mentalics are, but you might be onto something there, Fred.
The only people I'm ruling out, I guess, are Harry because he doesn't have these powers. He's not sighted, and Gale and Salvor themselves, but everybody else.
Yeah. Harry, absolutely not. I mean, look, I've said this before. You can do anything as long as you do it well. But subverting the ultimate protagonist from the original books to be the ultimate antagonist seems to be a bit much.
Yeah, might be a bridge too far.
But again, I'd have to see it before I'd condemn it. That's all we have for feedback this week. If you are sending feedback, make sure if you are sending feedback intended for David Goyer, because again, you missed your first opportunity for questions, but there will be one at the end of the season. If you'd like to send in a piece of feedback into cryo storage for the end of the season, make sure you put a Goyer in that subject line so I'll know to search for it when that time comes. That's foundation@baldmove.com for feedback. If you'd like to follow us along to see what else we're doing, because currently we've got what are we doing right now, Jim?
Justified City Primeval. We're about to start up
Ahsoka, the new Star Wars series. We've got Walking Dead's Daryl Dixon spinoff that we're considering. Seems like we got a release date for Fargo, I think. Fargo season 5. Lots of cool stuff coming up. Best way to keep up with what we're doing at Bald Move is searching for @BaldMove on your favorite social media app, with the exception of TikTok. We're @BaldestMove there. Finally, if you like our podcast, you've been listening to for a while, you want to know how to help keep us podcasting and get a bunch of cool stuff like ad-free feeds, extra bonus audio, video content, check out support.baldmove.com. We'd love to have you in the club. that does it for this week's Foundation episode. Can't wait again to see what happens next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Respect and enjoy the podcast.